Welcome to the Venuccio Novak Report. Frank, we hope you're back soon and you're feeling better during this Christmas and Hanukkah season for everybody. This is Daria Novak reporting from Washington.
And this is John Wilson reporting from Florida.
You know, John, I hope that you do have a happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, or you had mentioned another holiday that I actually hadn't heard of, Festive.
Festivus. Don't forget to wish your neighbors a happy Festivus as well, especially when they want to participate in the airing of the grievances.
And you know what? I think we have a lot of people in this country this year that have been grievancing about many things. You know, Frank and I would talk about gun control and issues around that. But, you know, John, lately we've seen a number of incidents. And even though it is the Christmas season, I would like to talk to you a little bit about what's going on in Australia. We saw the shooting on the Bundy Beach and a number of people in what was considered to be the, I believe, the largest shooting, mass shooting in Australia. But I think this goes back all the way to 1996 with Port Arthur, when a young, he's basically mentally ill individual, had killed about 35 people, I think it was. And at that time, it was the world's deadliest mass shooting. So we, after that, see all these gun control laws going in. But you know, before this show, John, I went and looked at the data from the FBI and different groups that look at gun control laws. It's gotten worse, but we have more gun control laws. What's going on?
It's ironic, isn't it, that in jurisdictions where the gun control laws are the strictest, that's where you'll find the most of these mass shooting incidents. And that is just statistical evidence. That's not a debate. That's not whether you're pro-gun control or anti-gun control. It's just a matter of statistical evidence that many of these incidents occur in jurisdictions where gun control is strongest. And I believe there's a reason for that. Gun control, quite frankly, often takes the guns out of the hands of law-abiding citizens. The persons who follow the gun control laws are the persons who follow the laws. The persons who do not follow the laws are the people who end up with the guns in their hands. They're not turning their guns in. They're not following the laws. And so those are the persons who are most likely to commit criminal acts with their guns. In Australia, we have a situation where apparently it were legal gun owners that, or at least the father, not the son, was a legal gun owner. The son actually was on the terror watch list, leaving it incomprehensible why the Australian authorities would leave an arsenal in the hands of a father whose son is on the terror watch list. But be that as it may, it is persons who refuse to follow the laws who are involved in these shootings, not the law-abiding citizens. Those are the ones who give up their guns and go to gun-free zones and then become targets for those who are not following the law. It really is just as simple as that. Do you remember the shooting in Aurora, Colorado at the movie theater?
Yes.
That person went past several other theaters because they were not gun-free zones. He waited to find a theater that was a gun-free zone, knowing that he wouldn't have anybody to oppose his rampage.
You know, John, when you were a judge and using that background, I just have to ask you this question. Do you think anybody that ends up in court over the problems related to guns ever has said, you know, it was a gun-free zone, I didn't go to that area? I mean, does anyone pay attention to those signs? No guns allowed?
No, not if they're intending on committing a crime or a mass shooting. And if they do pay attention to the sign, it's to know that that's an area where they're able to free fire without anybody able to oppose them. You'll notice that some of the mass shootings have been stopped in instances where a citizen with a legal gun stopped that person from firing their gun more than once or twice, saving countless lives in the process. So the fallacy of gun control is thinking that persons who are not going to follow the law in the first place aren't going to get their hands on a gun. And by the way, you saw the recent tragic death of Rob Reiner, who was always a gun control advocate, who was killed with a knife, he and his wife. Maybe he should have been advocating for the control of knives. It wouldn't have made a difference. When a person intends on killing, they're going to use whatever means they can get their hands on. Do you remember the series of trucks that were being used by terrorists in New York and other jurisdictions to run down people? They're going to use a truck. They're going to use a knife. They're going to use whatever comes to hand. That's the fallacy of gun control.
Well, you know, I really did look into this before the show because I was interested in, are the numbers alike when you look at different groups? And what I found was that the Australian government literally spent $200 million on this program to bring back, I shouldn't say to bring back, to take back one third of the guns in Australia. So this is a massive, massive effort. So you can't just say it was in one city or one town. This was across a huge country, and it didn't work.
Right.
So
learning nothing, the Canadians are doing the exact same thing. They also have instituted laws to try to take back guns from law-abiding citizens. Do you think they'll have any success with that? Absolutely not.
Well, all we could think about is there's got to be a better way to do this. How do we protect the rights of gun owners at the same time protect those in the general population from those who are using guns improperly? What do you think is a good balance?
I actually have a proposal in that regard, and I've been thinking about this ever since I was a lawyer and a judge in New York City, handling cases of this nature. I don't think we need to take the guns out of people's hands. What we need to do is make people more comfortable at an earlier age with guns, with being able to use guns, with making them more comfortable with guns. Education at an earlier age, 12, 13 years old, in teaching young people what a gun is and how a gun functions. I think that would prevent a lot of accidents from people who aren't familiar with guns as well. Give people some training. I also believe that rather than restrict the ownership of guns, there should be training based upon what level of gun you want to have. For instance, you have a CDL license for those who drive trucks. Not everybody drives a truck. Not everybody can drive a truck. Not everybody can handle high-powered automatic weapons, but if you undergo the training necessary to show your proficiency in those weapons, just like you show your proficiency in driving a tractor trailer, you should then be able to show your proficiency in a higher caliber, more automatic weapon. So you don't need to take the guns out of people's hands. You just need to give them the proper training in the use of those weapons. And you will see then that I believe you'll have less of crimes of this nature. You know, remember that for a while I lived in North Dakota, and we had a very high gun ownership ratio in the population, but we had very few gun crimes. And that's not because we didn't have a very big population in North Dakota. Keep in mind, there's only about 800,000, 900,000 people live in the entire state. They only have one congressperson for the whole state. It's because everybody was armed, and those who would commit crimes knew that they were most likely going to face an armed populace. So you didn't have people robbing stores or committing mass crimes like this. They knew they were most likely going to get shot right back at. That's
Well, you know, one of the things that happened when I was young is my dad took us out. And we were taught about guns, how to shoot them, how to clean them, how to be responsible. They were locked up at home. We didn't have access to them at all when we were young. When my kids were young, I did the same thing. I brought them out to my dad's home and had my dad train them to make sure. We never saw accidents in the home. My kids were healthy mentally. They were good kids. I really didn't need to worry, but I personally chose not to have guns in the home, which was my right. But I strongly support the idea that you have the right to bear arms. If I look at the situation today, though, I see there's much, it seems to me that there's more mental illness involved than there was in the past.
And you bring up the other side of this coin, that there is a component involving mental illness that is being completely ignored by the media. When the media calls for, and Congress people call for gun control. And every time there's one of these shootings, right away, within minutes of the shooting, you hear for the calls of gun control. What's really needed is mental health control. There needs to be a better system for guarding people's mental health and for addressing those mental health problems. Too many of these shooters are reported as being on the radar of the police and the authorities, but they're doing nothing about them. They know darn well that these people are mentally ill, that they shouldn't have access to weapons. Yet, once they get their hands on weapons, all of a sudden it becomes the gun's fault, not the mental illness's fault.
It's an interesting topic, and I'd like to bring on our first guest now, that John. Today we have with us Guy Wehman. Guy is a host and executive producer of the Ozarks This Morning and a longtime friend of Frank Venuccio of mine. Great to have you on the show today with us, Guy. How's everything going?
Thank you, Daria. And John, it's good to see you as well.
You too, Guy. A real pleasure.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the invite.
Guy, I was thinking about different topics that, we're getting to the end of the year and the Christmas season and all that. And I was looking over the past few months of what's been going on. And it seems to me, and maybe it's anecdotal, but I don't think so, it seems that there's been a dramatic rise in anti-Semitic behavior in this country and around the globe. So before the show, Guy, I went and looked at some of the data, and this isn't just this year. It's been increasing for several years now. What's going on? I thought that we would have learned our lessons after World War II.
Well, I think we might have, but we've got to go back probably to 2008 with when President Barack Obama came into office. Okay. I think that there's many other turning points. I mean, we can go back, but it seems like there was a term that was not being willing to be, they people in office were not willing to say radical Islam. They refrained from those two words, putting it together. And we have seen an influx of the Islamic nation going into Europe as a whole. We've seen it in Germany. We've seen it with the election of the mayor of London, for example, and the influx in there. Well, we've seen it here under O'Biden, yes, under President Biden, where millions of people came into this country unvetted. They just poured in. And so what I think we're seeing in these last even few weeks here, if you look at what happened in Australia, that's not here, but you look at what is going on with all the shootings and everything, it keeps on going back to that one point of a radical Islamic nature. And they make no bones about it. They're willing to die for their cause, and they want to implant Sharia law into this country. John can probably attest to that and talk about that. But they being willing to die, they'd have no desire to assimilate to being a United States citizen. They don't care about that. They just want to turn this into another caliphate of Islam.
And when we look at these type of incidents, we see that it's hate crimes against Jews among all religions. It's against the Jewish people where it's highest. John, did you want to add in?
Yeah, Guy, I'd like to address the root of some of this anti-Semitism and get your comment on this. It would seem to me that much of the anti-Semitism that's experienced now, not the historic anti-Semitism, but much of what you're seeing now is fueled by conspiracy theories involving the Israelis. I have seen, and I'm sure you have too, a host of conspiracy theories, all involving the Israelis and Jeffrey Epstein, the Israelis and 9/11, the Israelis and all sorts of other international incidents. And it would seem to me that an outgrowth of all of this false and misleading information about the Israelis and about Israel is the root of much of the anti-Semitism that we're seeing today in much of the conspiracy theories. What do you think of that guy?
Well, I tend to agree with that, and why I do is like it's almost like code word, because when they start popping out these fake news media reports and they start pushing out this fake stuff, because that's what it is, because 2% of the population in the United States is Jewish, okay? 12% it would be of the black community. And so if you start looking at all these breakdowns, but when they start pushing these anti-Semitic or anti-Semitic rants and raves and things of that nature, that's when we start to see these attacks come up even more and more. So it's like, yeah, it's okay to be against the Jews because, well, we've allowed it. Well, this is what's been happening. And you look at TikTok and Instagram, all these media accounts, they foment, boy, that's a good word, of the hatred against.
Well, it's interesting, Guy, you brought up, this is not a new phenomenon. If you look at 1979 as a base year, and if everybody remembers, we had the Iran hostage situation going on. So if you look at that as a base year and you look at today, we've seen about an 893% increase in incidents that are occurring like this. What this basically means is that today there's more than 25 anti-Semitic incidents every day in this country. That's like more than 1 an hour. Is there any way that we're going to see a change, do you think, in this? Could we get past these types of figures? They seem to be ranking record highs according to the FBI data, ADL. The Anti-Defamation League data. It just seems that this going off the charts lately. What do we do?
Well, that was at the end of the Jimmy Carter presidency is when that happened, okay? And they were not going to, let's talk about the hostages. They were not going to release those. And then President Reagan came into office. I think they were captive like 460 some days or something like that. And then Reagan is tough, okay? He was tough with the military and everything. They started to back away. Well, Trump is equally as tough, but we've had some other cushion areas along the way, whether it was Clinton and George W. Bush. He was maybe tough when he got on that big pile at 9/11 in New York City with the bullhorn, but outside of that, he was not as tough as what people wanted him to be. And then with Obama, it's like, sure, go ahead. And then Biden, I mean, I don't even know if he knew what country he was in.
I've got to just point out what I really like looking at data points from a number of groups because the media just lies to the American people so much, the mainstream media. So before the show, I always try to find a few different sources to make sure they're saying about the same thing. And something really shocked me, Combat Anti-Semitism Movement. They said that there is a doubling of documented incidents globally from 2023 to 2024. This seems like things are getting worse, not better. I'm wondering, can we save Europe? When I looked at the numbers in Europe, whether it was the UK, Germany, Italy, we see the anti-Jewish behavior in general there. Really becoming very strong. Is Europe gone?
I want to say no, but at the same time, I want to say yes. And let me kind of phrase that because you have Meloni in Italy, she's strong. And you have the leader in Hungary, and they're strong. You need a Farage to get in there in the United Kingdom because he would be strong once again. When you mentioned the 23 to 24 time frame, doesn't that parallel Jimmy Carter in those last years? And that was the last couple of years of Joe Biden's term. So it's these weak precedents is that, okay, they kind of weigh things out. Afghanistan's got to play into that because that is what Russia saw. They saw how we screwed that whole thing up, pulling out of Afghanistan. And Russia says, this is our time. They did not know who's going to win the 2024 election, whether it was going to be Kamala Harris, or if it was going to be Donald Trump. Well, Kamala Harris, she was equally out to lunch because she was on the six-pack wino tour there because she was following the Pelosi, the grapes and all that stuff. But you know what I'm talking about. If you have a strong leader in Farage, and if you have a strong leader, Maloney is very strong. People do respect her. Germany and the EU, well, Germany's got some problems, and the EU keeps wanting to push us around. And that's when Trump says, no, wait a minute, this is our policy. And Rubio is very clear on that. This is the United States. You're not telling us what to do on our soil.
Well, Guy, maybe it's time to switch gears and talk about another issue involving a strong leader. As you know, President Trump has been leading a charge against narco terrorism, declaring Tren de Aragua a branch of the Venezuelan government's efforts to destabilize the United States. And so, narco terrorist boats transferring drugs from Venezuela to our shores have been the targets of the US military and Coast Guard. There are those who feel that these are extrajudicial killings and are acts almost of piracy. The Maduro regime has called these acts of piracy. What's your position on the actions taken by the Trump administration to combat these narco terrorists?
Well, it is in international water. They have determined that the product that's on those boats, that it is drugs, it is, and it's fentanyl and all those other drugs and cocaine and everything that has been coming onto our shore, and it is killing Americans. Make no mistake about that. Just a small little speck of fentanyl is enough to kill anybody. And so Donald Trump, he promised this, that he wanted to take out the drugs of what's going on. We haven't even talked about the northern border with what's coming across to Canada, like in Vermont and up in there. But as far as those open waters and stuff, I think it's a great thing. It's what Trump said he was going to do, where, and he's blowing them up. These are bad guys. Let's not candy coat it. The fake media and everything. Well, these guys are just on a boat and they're trying to get to America. Well, guess what? If they're trying to get to America, they'd still be illegal aliens. They don't even belong here anyways. What are we trying to save these people? They don't belong in this country. If you want to be an American, assimilate to the American flag, unlike a certain congressperson in Minnesota that's got an 80,000 populace of Somalians up there. You chuckled at that one, didn't you, Daria?
I did because what everything you're saying is so right on, Guy. But you know what my favorite was? Some people in the left that were in the media that were trying to say these were fishing boats. And I'm laughing and I'm thinking, you know what? I grew up on coastal Connecticut and I've never seen a fishing boat that has like four or five of these huge outboard powerful motors. These are not any kind of fishing boat that I've ever seen. On top of that, I've never seen an open fishing boat with 55-gallon drums, one lined up after the other. You know, it is such a farce about what's coming out. But here's an interesting thing. Let's look at what's happening. If these boats aren't going to the US, where are the drugs going? We're starting to see more action in Europe. I wonder if the European governments are going to join in and try to stop drug trafficking in Europe because some of it comes here and some of it from Latin America is going over to Europe.
I hope that Europe is taking notice of this. What happens is that they look and see, and they're watching what Donald Trump does as the president. Okay. This is noticed not just here in the 50 states, but it's noticed all around the world. And leaders are watching this, and they're watching what the reaction is here. That's where the fake media comes in because they want to keep saying, well, this is not happening. No, it is happening, and we are correcting it. We're getting the people out of here that don't belong here. We are correcting the drugs and we're human trafficking. He's already put a stop to that as far as people coming across the border. So, as England, as Germany, and as these countries see, and even what happened in Australia. Now, this is an anti-Semitic hit down there with the people dying and everything. He is now taking some serious heat from the people of Australia because he should have been on top of this with the anti-Semitic movement. So they're watching a strong leader like what we have in Donald Trump, And if you want to hearken it back to George Washington or whatever, that's fine. But people are watching and they want to follow a winner. They want to follow what is going on here. And this is only, he's only been in office 11 months.
You know, when you and just go ahead, John.
Thank you. Guy, I wanted to bring up something we discussed on your show on In the News. I had mentioned this narco-terrorism issue before and pointed out that it didn't seem that it seemed that the Trump administration had the right information on these persons. Nobody was claiming that, oh, that was my father who was just a fisherman. But I need to correct that now. Someone has come forward with that claim. There's a Colombian family that you've seen in the news that says that their relative who was killed on one of these boats was nothing but a fisherman. However, the background of that person indicated that they did have a criminal history, and that criminal history did involve involvement with drugs and gangs. So the credibility seems to be lacking, because I'm not hearing much about that story after seeing it featured on some of the more more legacy media. There's also another Haitian family that claims one of their members, the family, was just a fisherman, but I've seen that story get even less press, meaning there's probably even less evidence involved with that person.
Well, you could put a fishing rod and reel next to all these drugs and everything, and they're saying, well, we were just fishing out here. But I dare say that when you start to look at all the other evidence, it's that it kind of puts that down to the wayside. And my heart goes out if it's their family and everything. But at the same time, those are drugs that were trying to come into our country. They were not trying to come into, I don't know, to Spain, because their boat wasn't headed that way.
You know, Guy, something hit me for the first time when you said Donald Trump has been in office 11 months. So much has happened in 11 months. It just all of a sudden I realized we're not even into 2026 yet, and we've seen amazing differences in this country. It seems to me that this president is the first one, I don't know, maybe since Ronald Reagan, who has actually campaigned on issues and done in office what he campaigned on. Do you see it that way?
Well, I see that they are deathly afraid, that they, meaning the left of this country and the progressives of this country, they do not want to see Donald Trump succeed. And he's got a strong cabinet. You know, all these cabinet members, they in their own right are strong businessmen, and they left that business community and they say, yes, we will serve at the pleasure of the president. You look at Burgum up there in the Dakotas. I mean, you go on down the list that these are all top smart people, and yet they're saying, we're following the lead of the president of the United States, and they are proud and happy, and the cabinet is unified. I mean, John, Daria, you know what I'm talking about here.
You know, it is just amazing to me to see the difference in how the country feels. You know, it's hard times. You don't just switch off what's happening and go to a new path immediately. It's to me like the tide was going out under Biden. And now there's all of the sand being churned up as the tide starts coming back in, and we got problems to work through, but we are working through. I mean, we were told, if you remember, a couple of years ago that we didn't have a border problem. Biden wouldn't admit it. His official, Biden or Kamala Harris, didn't show up at the border to look at anything. And now, how in just, as you mentioned, 11 months in, we're seeing a whole different picture. So, Guy, tell us what you think 2026 is going to look like under the Trump administration.
Oh, my goodness. Well, this is like Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't it? You know, we don't have a drinking problem. We don't have a border problem. The first thing is you have to admit you have the problem. Well, Trump has said to this country, you have a problem. We're going to fix it. What's going to happen in 2026? I don't have a crystal ball. However, the big, beautiful bill is going to kick in. And so we've been now waiting, what, 6 or 7 months. The bill has already been passed, but it starts January 1st. A lot of these things are going to be backdated. People will notice it when they fill out their taxes, and they're going to say, wow, because this is going to be retroactive to the January 1st of 2025. Now, what's going to happen? I think people are going to have more money in their pocket. We're seeing gas prices down, the lowest they've been in a long time. At present, the national average is at $2.90 a gallon. And so that's already less. I think the first time we've seen it that low is like 2018 or something like that. So now we're starting to drop that. Energy prices helps fuel all the other things. And so we're going to see like groceries and those, they're going to start to drop as well. Because if you have a delivery truck for like, say, dry cleaning, that needs gasoline to send it there. Well, if that's going down, the costs are going to lower down because they want to make sure that the people are set. People are going to get more and more confident with Donald Trump in office. The cabinet is starting to work, and it's going to be an exciting 3 to 4 months going into 2026. I'm anxious to see my tax return.
Midterm elections. We see so many different issues coming up. Are the Republicans in trouble, or are we in a good place coming into the midterms?
The honest truth, we're in trouble. And I say that we're in trouble because I love Donald Trump and his policies, but he needs to be quiet because sometimes he puts his foot in the mouth and it's like, you know, you just kind of have to just let things kind of go. And it would be fine if we didn't see you for like 30 days and let the country just kind of reel on and let Rubio do his shtick and let J.D. Vance take a couple of hits, you know, and then you've got all these other great people in the cabinet. Let them do their thing. And just kind of lean back and let them do it. You've already empowered them. They feel that already. And then you don't put your foot in your mouth. And that's my big fear. And people, I mean, he is like kryptonite sometimes, or nuclear, as they say. So you don't want to touch it. John, you're shaking your head. I see that.
That's kind of what we love and hate about him all at the same time, yes. Don't we? The man gets things done. The man is very active in his office. The difference between him and Biden is night and day. You've got a president who's actually engaged and involved, as opposed to one who is eating ice cream and taking a nap. But you got to take the good with the bad. And sometimes Donald Trump is going to say something we don't like, we don't agree with, and we think is crass or rude or just not the right thing to say.
You know, another thing is this ballroom. And the media is jumping all over this ballroom. Okay, maybe he jumped the gun and demolished the East Wing. We all saw that happen. But remember, too, he's not going to be able to really enjoy much of this ballroom because it's going to be done at the end of the term that he's presently in. And when they have all of these events, the present ballroom that they did have could not seat everybody. So they had all these tents and everything all around the White House lawn. Number one, that did not look as presidential and executive as they would like for the White House and the United States of America. So he's cleaned up Washington, D.C. That is happening with that new ballroom. When people go in there, everybody will be able to be under one roof all together. They'll be protected because the Secret Service can contain that room as opposed to all these different tents. And they say, well, Trump, you're doing it for you. Well, he's not going to really get to enjoy it because it's going to take 3 years or so to finish this thing up. It'll be like 27 before maybe early 28 when it's done.
And this isn't the first renovation of the White House either. We need to recognize that. There have been gardens that have been changed. There have been swimming pools that have been put in and taken out, and bowling alleys and different things that have gone on through the years. It seems to me that no matter what Donald Trump does, the media, the mainstream media, is going to go after him. If they can't find one thing, they'll find another to pick on him. You know what? I worked in the government for over 10 years at the State Department. And during that time, up until today, a lot of Washington functions that should have gone on at the White House had to take place at the State Department because the State Department had the largest diplomatic reception rooms in Washington. The White House couldn't handle it. And it was a bit embarrassing when you would see what was happening. So to me, it's like Donald Trump across the board is a transactional president. He sees a problem just like a business leader. He finds out what the possible solutions are, and he goes and does something about it. If I had to think about what Joe Biden did during his time in office, Guy, I'm not sure I can think of any positive things.
Well, they tried to change the font on the official paperwork from the State Department. So it was Times New Roman this whole time, and then they changed it to Caligri or something like that, some other font, and now they're changing it back to what it always was. Well, they're all up in arms. Well, you can't change the font on our official stationery and everything. Well, Rubio went in there and says, "Yes, we will."
Well, back in 1978, 79, government paper size was 8 by 10 and a half. And it took millions of dollars, and they changed it to 8 and a half by 11. Cost the government a bit of money, but we got rid of duplication and copiers and things like that. Nobody complained about it. It was just a simple thing that needed to be done. It seems with this administration, the left is not going to let anything rest, whether it's a paper size, a font, things like that. But we have more important things to worry about. We only have you for about 1 more minute, I believe, or 1 or 2 minutes, Guy. What do you think about what I think is the biggest problem we're facing, and that's with China?
Oh my goodness. Well,
Give us a 1 minute summary.
Oh, okay. I think China's a big problem. Trump brought up, Trump put China on the radar in his first term. Until then, nobody was really talking about it, and he brought it up, and now people are recognizing China is a problem. They're starting to recognize it's a communist nation, even though they were a communist nation the whole time. And so, as far as China goes, Trump put it back on everybody's eyes and said, okay, this is where we need to be looking. And thank goodness that he did that.
That is the truth. I'm glad because China is a threat to us and we need to think long term. And this president finally is doing something about it. It may inconvenience some Americans in the short run, but with jobs coming back and manufacturing and critical supply chain, we're in good luck. Guy, how can people listen to your show and find out more about what you're doing these days?
Well, there's an app. It's KRMS Radio, so you can go to the App Store and you can download it. I'm on 6 to 9, Monday through Friday. That is Central Time. It's called the Ozarks This Morning, and we have different things we feature. Like on Fridays, we talk movies and we talk sports, and we've got fishing and just different things that pertain to the Lake of the Ozarks. However, we do talk international and national news as well, and with Frank Fornuscio and Ben Brunson and myself, and we have John, and we've had you on the program. We plug those elements into the show as well.
Well, we'll have to have you back in 2026 and we'll see how things go then.
All right, thanks
Have
so much.
thank you. John, I think 2026 is going to be an important year. Let's go to our next guest. We have a really fascinating individual with us today. Reggie Littlejohn is a renowned human rights attorney and founder of Women's Rights Without Borders and Anti-Globalist International. She's warning us that 78-year-old Jimmy Lai's life is now in immediate danger in a Hong Kong prison. We don't hear about this often in the mainstream media. It's not the story that fits the agenda of the left. Reggie, can you tell us what's going on in Hong Kong? What's going on in China? And who's Jimmy Lai?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. And yes, this story has not gotten nearly as much play as it should, because people really should know about this. Jimmy Lai is an international hero. He is someone who grew up in mainland China. His parents were wealthy, and so they were attacked by during the Cultural Revolution, taken away from the family. He and his sibling grew up in a house alone as little kids. He got a job, or no, he didn't get a job. He tried to make a little bit of money carrying people's luggage at the local train station. And somebody at the train station whose luggage he was carrying gave him a little chocolate bar. And when he t tasted this chocolate bar, he said, "Where did you get that?" And he said, "I got it in Hong Kong." And he said, "Well, Hong Kong must be heaven because this tastes like heaven." So then he determined to go to Hong Kong. He stowed away as a 12-year-old and
Wow.
arrived in Hong Kong, immediately was put to work in one of the factories, but didn't feel like he was, child labor, although he was, okay? But rose through the ranks to become one of the richest and most powerful people in Hong Kong. He founded his own clothing line. He became a British citizen. He founded something called the Apple Daily, and this is what got him into trouble, which is the Apple Daily was a newspaper that dared to criticize the Chinese Communist Party. So when Tiananmen Square happened, he criticized the government for the massacre that happened on Tiananmen Square. These are just freedom fighters, and we don't know how many people were killed, possibly thousands of students. So then, since that time, he has been a leader, or had been a leader, in Hong Kong of the resistance, particularly when China, took back Hong Kong from British rule, and they imposed something called the National Security Law, which at the time I said this is going to be used to crush dissent, and that's exactly what it was. And they have used that National Security Law to detain Jimmy Lai. He's been detained since December of 2020. So 5 years in solitary confinement. He is now 78 years old. He is in failing health. So in this solitary confinement, he has basically little or no access to natural light. He has diabetes. He has a heart condition. He has high blood pressure. He's not getting medication for any of it. During the summer, this cell gets up to 111 degrees. Can you imagine 111 degrees for somebody who's 78 years old? So his children are very, very worried that he's going to die in prison. And I think that's an absolutely legitimate worry. And just this week, in the last couple of days, a Hong Kong court came down and had a verdict against him. They decided that he was guilty of conspiracy to collude with foreign forces and conspiracy to publish seditious materials. What does that mean? It means that what he did is he published the truth about Tiananmen Square and about the Chinese takeover of Hong Kong, and he talked to foreign people in government about it. I mean, this is basic free speech and also freedom of assembly, all of that, and for that he's been in jail in solitary confinement for 5 years.
You know, when Hong Kong was, oh, go ahead, John.
Can I ask what efforts are being made by first by the Biden administration, then now by the Trump administration to assist Mr. Lai?
Well, I don't know what happened under Biden, but I do know that President Trump has a couple of times said he's personally aware of the case of Jimmy Lai, and he said recently that he spoke with President Xi Jinping about Jimmy Lai. And he said, and we'll see what happens. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know whether President Xi Jinping is just going to rudely ignore President Trump. But President Trump is aware of it, and so is the US Congress. In the past, they have passed, resolutions on his behalf. The United Nations, one of their committees has made a statement on his behalf. So he has garnered international attention. And some people would say, oh, well, with all that international attention, the Chinese Communist Party wouldn't dare to just let him die in jail. And I say, that view is naive, because they did the same thing to Liu Xiaobo. I don't know if you remember Liu Xiaobo, but he was actually nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. He was a dissident, and he got cancer, and they did not allow him to come out, and he died in jail. So they just, the Chinese Communist Party really thinks that it's above the law. It thinks that it's above morality. Basically, I think that it thinks that it's God, and I can talk about why I think that. But so I think that that without international pressure, they will let him die in jail. So he's been convicted, but he has not been sentenced. The sentence is in January, and my hope and prayer is that even though these charges can carry up to life imprisonment, a life sentence, which for him would be a death sentence, even a couple years could be a death sentence for him at his age and with his, I forgot to even mention some of the problems he's having. His daughter, has seen him, and she said that he's lost an alarming amount of weight, and that his teeth and his fingernails are rotting.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah, I mean, this is terrible. This guy is a huge hero. He could have left at any time, okay? He is a British citizen. He could have left when all this unrest was happening in Hong Kong. He could have left and just gone to Britain. And he said, "No, I can't." He said, "I'm a troublemaker." He said, "I can't make trouble and then just leave." You know, I mean, he feels that he owes everything to Hong Kong because, you know, he went from a life of complete misery in China to a life that is almost unbelievable, unimaginable in Hong Kong. And so he has a commitment to Hong Kong. He also has a commitment to truth. He's a committed Catholic Christian. And, you know, so that's where he gets his strength to keep going. He's reading the Bible. He's drawing pictures of Jesus on the cross. You know, this is where he's getting his strength.
You know, Reggie, if we look at Chinese negotiating behavior, and that's what President Trump has to deal with Xi Jinping, the Americans for many years have been very poor at understanding how the Chinese operate from a PR point of view, as well as just every type of trade negotiation, etc. China will push and push the West, especially the US, to get as many concessions as possible. And only when they don't get more concessions are they actually willing to sit down and really conduct an honest to God negotiation. I shouldn't even say honest to God. It's probably not a good expression with the Chinese. That's just a colloquial one for me. But we need to see President Trump pushing back as hard as possible, because if he doesn't, we're not going to see any movement from the Chinese. And we have seen this time and time again with China in trade talks, in other human rights cases. Anytime China can take advantage of the West, of the US, they do. Yet I don't see the leftist human rights groups really coming out and talking about Jimmy Lai, making it a big issue.
Well, China's MO, it seems to me, is they will negotiate to get as many concessions out of the West as they can, right? Just like you said, with no intention whatsoever of upholding their end of the bargain. So they'll get us to make all these promises. They'll make promises in turn. We'll keep our promises, and they'll just, you know, break their promises. And you can see that in the handover, the way they handled the handover of Hong Kong back to China. But yes, we need President Trump to make it a priority, although he has. I mean, I don't know what he can do beyond personally raising Jimmy Lai's case with President Xi. I mean, that's as high level as you can get. But what we do need is an international outcry. So I just want to mention that on my website, this antiglobalist.net, that's antiglobalist.net. We have right there on the homepage is a petition to free Jimmy Lai. And we want to get as many thousands of signatures from all over the world on that petition so that we can say, you know, we have however many thousands of signatures from however many hundreds of countries supporting, you know, the release of Jimmy Lai and really have an international outcry on his behalf.
Now, can I follow up on the issue of Hong Kong being handed over to the Chinese? There were British citizens like Jimmy Lai who were living in Hong Kong at the time when the handover occurred. Could they then become Chinese citizens, or did they remain British citizens? And if they're still British citizens, what's the British government doing to help after this?
Well, that is a detail of immigration law that I am not familiar with. But I do know that Jimmy Lai you know, was putting out information on the Apple Daily every single day, detailing all the terrible things they were doing. He was out there in the streets as an elderly man leading these protests. And so what is that he is a hero of free speech. He's a hero of genuine journalism. And he has done absolutely nothing wrong. And so what they're doing with this national security law is basically they have weaponized it in order to kill dissent. So basically, you know, you cannot dissent. And let me say something else that's very interesting and disturbing about this national security law, okay? It's not just for citizens of Hong Kong. It's not just for citizens of China. It's not just for criticizing the government in Hong Kong. Their law reaches worldwide. So that anyone who criticizes them, whether they're a Chinese citizen or not, or a Hong Kong citizen or not, anywhere in the world, as far as they're concerned, comes under their national security law. So that means the three of us, right? We're in this together here, but all three of us are violating Hong Kong's national security law right now. And as far as they're concerned, I'm sure if they could get away with it, they would try to get all of us extradited and tried in mainland China. So who knows what would happen to us there?
Well, you know
Reminds
what,
me of
and
the British law now too, with the British trying to control social media and trying to control any sort of anti-Muslim sentiment or anti-transgender sentiment that might be expressed. I think the British would be just as quick to try to arrest this as the Chinese these days.
Well, and this is all coming down through the World Health Organization as well. So, what, as you know, I'm the president of Women's Rights Without Frontiers. We started out opposing forced abortion in China. And when I did that, I saw how the Chinese Communist Party works and how their Chinese style totalitarianism works. And I became very alarmed to see that same system coming down through the World Health Organization, which is why I founded Anti-Globus International. But they are putting out like a system of digital IDs, which could form the same platform as the China social credit system, which rates everybody in terms of how compliant of a Chinese communist slave or you are, and if you buck the government, you can end up losing your, losing your home, losing your job, losing your being severed from your bank accounts and your credit cards. And people think that can't happen here. It did to the Canadian truckers when they had that protest against the vaccine mandates. But so this thing about these health IDs, international interoperable health IDs that are being pushed out through the World Health Organization, especially if you combine them with central bank digital currencies, can form what I call the digital gulag and trap all of us. And the World Health Organization, even in the pandemic treaty and in the amendments to the international health regulations, talk about misinformation and disinformation. And they're the ones who get to decide what is misinformation and disinformation, which is basically anything, including things that are true, that disagree with the narrative that is being pushed out by the World Health Organization at the moment.
I just want, before we lose you, to point out something that this is with Chinese behavior that goes back to the 1980s and before with the one-child policy. It was declassified, so I'm not saying anything that I shouldn't, but during my time at the State Department, we got in information and it was confirmed. The United Nations, using US money, was buying formaldehyde and ship and having it paid for and given to the Chinese, and they were using it to perform abortions as a child was crowning. And in county hospitals, in especially in the Mongolian sort of region of China, that central northern area, in the county hospitals, they were given quotas in those days. So many babies could be born, and there were two areas. You didn't know whether you were going into the one that was birthing room or the abortion room, and whether it was your first child or not. If you went over the quota system, the baby's head was injected with formaldehyde to cause it to convulse and die before it was fully emerged. Under Chinese law, still today, a person, and I'm calling a baby a person, does not have any rights in China until it is fully born. This is so abhorrent to me, and very few people are willing to actually talk about it. I don't want to know about it. But this is what we're facing in China. There is no respect for human life in that country.
You know something, it's very rare that I learn something new, but I actually learned something new from you right now. I knew about the killing the babies with formaldehyde to the brain, they're being born. And I actually submitted to Congress a something that I called Best Practices Infanticide, which was on the official Chinese OBGYN website, about how to kill babies as they're being born to make sure they're not born alive. What I didn't know is that the United Nations was funding it.
UNPL 480.
Could you please send that to me? I want to give you my email address. I need that information. That's sickening. It's utterly sickening.
It is. And on this show, we've always made a deal, whether it sounds pretty or not, we're going to talk about the truth here and we can back it up with the facts. I'd be happy to send it to you. But on a happier note, Merry Christmas to you. Happy New Year. Happy Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate. And can you please tell us how our guests that are listening and watching you today can get in touch with you and your organizations?
Okay, so please go to antiglobalist.net. That's one word, antiglobalist.net, and sign the petition to free Jimmy Lai. It's urgent. And then if you want to support our work, we are saving baby girls and abandoned widows in China. Go to womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org and you can find out how you can support a baby girl or an abandoned widow in China.
Thank you, Reggie, so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back on the show in 2026 to get an update on Jimmy Lai and what else is happening with your group.
Thank you so very much. And I look forward to hearing from you with that link.
No problem. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We welcome our newest markets today in Odessa, Texas at 93.3 FM, Liberty, Missouri 89.5 FM, and Butler, Alabama at 96.3 FM. We're expanding into a number of major media markets, including Washington, D.C. at 96.7 FM, Las Vegas, Nevada at 92.1 FM, Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 1640 AM and 102.1 FM, Tampa, Florida at 92.1 FM, Ritchie, Florida, 88.3 FM, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 90.3 FM, Macon, Georgia, 810 AM and 98.3 FM, Boulder, Colorado, 100.7 FM, Long Beach, California, 101.5 FM, and in Pittsburgh at 107.3 FM. We also welcome Tucson, Arizona at 95.0 FM and Provo, Utah at 90.5 FM. We're available on the AMFM247.com, iHeart, Spreaker, and Conservative Commandos. Tell Alexa to play the program. Tune in to our television show, The American Political Zone, on the AUN Network, Roku, and Public Broadcast TV. Thanks for listening and join us again next week. We're sponsored by the New York Analysis of Policy and Government, a division of the American Analysis of News and Media, Inc. at usagovpolicy.com and the International Center for Great Power Studies and Diplomacy. Email us at truthandradio@gmail.com and tune in to the American Political Zone television show, also on the AMFM247.com network. And thanks to the brilliant Jeff Hansen, our director.